Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 96.
In 18th century high society, dropping a piece of casually embroidered silk could be, you know, exactly as lethal as swallowing a vial of arsenic.
Yeah, easily.
Right. So today we are looking at a family so utterly desperate to survive this this accelerating collapse that they actually decided to cure a fatal medical illness with a fake wedding.
Which is just wild to think about.
It's unbelievable. And they did it knowing full well that the quote unquote cure might actually execute the patient.
Right.
We're examining a sprawling autonomous family compound that operates, more like a sovereign city state than a standard household.
Yeah, it's massive.
And we have this huge stack of source notes covering counterfeit magical objects, secret arranged marriages, desperate medical treatments, and a truly mind-shattering betrayal.
It's a lot to get through.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. Before we get to the counterfeit jade and the whole fake wedding situation.
This massive, almost corporate-like entity is facing insolvency.
Like financial insolvency.
Well, financially, yes, but more importantly, spiritually and politically.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because the patriarch, Jie Zheng, is preparing to leave on a critical imperial assignment, meaning the ultimate male authority figure is vacating the premises.
Right, he's just leaving a vacuum.
Exactly. And the matriarch, Grandmother Jia, who acts as sort of the ultimate majority shareholder of the family.
I like that term.
Yeah, she is desperately trying to maintain control. But the most immediate crisis centers around the family's beloved heir, Ba Yu.
And he's the one who's sick, right?
Well, sick is putting it mildly. Ba Yu is quite literally losing his mind because he has lost his defining asset.
Right, he's jade.
Yeah, a magical inscribed jade stone that he was supposedly born with in his mouth.
Which is just such a wild detail. And the adults in the room, rather than, you know, facing the reality of their declining influence and the heir's deteriorating mental state, they decide to pivot.
Yes, aggressively.
They plot this massive, elaborate deception. They try to save the structural integrity of the family by building what is essentially a fragile house of lies. How a family constructs that kind of deceit and what happens when that heavy, fragile structure inevitably collapses onto a vulnerable young woman who never even saw it coming.
It's a tragedy in the truest sense.
So let's jump straight into the first breach of the family's defenses. We begin with an incident that I can only really describe as like an 18th century case of analog identity theft.
That's a perfect way to phrase it.
The case of the fake jade.
Mm.
So we start in a study inside the mansion. A furious family manager, Jia Lian, has apprehended a man who has done something profoundly dangerous.
Very dangerous.
He has forged a counterfeit of Ba Yu's famous missing magical jade, and Jia Lian is absolutely livid, ordering the man to be tied up.
Right.
So walk us through the stakes of this specific crime. Why is a fake piece of jewelry such a massive existential threat?
Well, what's fascinating here is that you really have to understand the mechanics of the original jade to grasp why forging it is treated as a capital offense by Jia Lian.
Okay.
In the cosmology of this narrative, this isn't just a family heirloom passed down through generations, like a nice watch.
Right, it's not just expensive.
Exactly. The myth is that Bao Yu was literally born with this stone in his mouth. It is the physical manifestation of his vital essence.
His soul, basically.
His cosmic mandate, yeah. And by extension, it's the spiritual anchor of the entire family's future.
Wow.
The inscriptions on a real stone supposedly ward off evil and guarantee his destiny. So when this counterfeiter carves a piece of regular jade to look exactly like the magical one, he isn't just making a cheap knockoff to sell at a local market.
Right, he's stepping into something sacred.
He is actively profiting off the spiritual void at the center of the Jia family. So Jia Lian demands the man be bound with ropes immediately and threatens to hand him over to the local magistrates the absolute moment the patriarch returns.
Because in Jia Lian's eyes, this forgery is a direct attack on the family's core identity.
Exactly. It's treason against the family myth.
But the counterfeiter's reaction is what really shifts the dynamic here, I think.
Oh, entirely.
Because he doesn't act like some master criminal caught in the act. He doesn't strike a defiant pose or try to negotiate a deal. The moment Jia Lian threatens him, his legs literally give out.
It just collapses.
He drops to his knees, utterly terrified, and his defense is this fascinating glimpse into the world outside the high walls of the mansion.
Yeah, it brings reality crashing in.
He claims that extreme poverty, like pure economic desperation, drove him to carve the fake jade.
Right.
He tells Jia Lian that he actually had to borrow money just to buy the raw materials.
Which is incredibly risky for a peasant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hoping he could either present it to, quote, honor the boy in the mansion or, you know, more realistically, claim a massive reward from the family who is publicly desperate to find the missing stone.
Right. He was looking for a payout.
Yeah. But now, faced with the actual wrath of a nobleman, he's just begging for mercy. He says he doesn't even want any money anymore.
He just wants to survive.
Right. He just wants to give them the stone to play with and escape with his life.
The counterfeiter instantly recognizes that he has stepped onto a massive geopolitical landmine.
Yeah, he really messed up.
He is a peasant dealing with aristocrats who have the power to ruin or just end his life without a second thought. He thought he was playing a simple grift, but he accidentally touched the family's most raw nerve.
Yeah.
But the most revealing part of this entire scene isn't Jaelian's anger, and it isn't even the counterfeiter's terror. It is the intervention of Lai Da.
Okay, yes, Lai Da. Let's talk about him.
Lai Da is the chief steward of the household. So he is a servant, technically, but because he controls the day-to-day operations and logistics of this massive estate, he wields immense practical power.
Like a chief operating officer.
Yes, exactly. And while Jaelian is ready to bring down the full weight of the imperial legal system on this man, Lai Da essentially steps in and tells Jaelian to stand down.
Which is surprising.
Very. He looks at the counterfeiter and says, in effect, this guy is a worthless nobody. He tells Jaelian to just kick him out and let him roll away.
Let him roll away.
And he means that literally. The guards outside threaten to kick the man in the chest if he doesn't scramble out the door fast enough.
Oh, wow.
Lai Dai's primary objective here is to avoid bringing any official legal attention to the family.
This fake jade incident is perfectly mirrored by a sudden, violent wave of actual news striking the family from the outside world.
It really pours when it rains.
Yeah, because tragedy, especially in systems that are already compromised, rarely strikes from just one direction.
No, it compounds.
Which brings us to the sudden death of Wang Ziteng and how it just exponentially increases the intense, crushing pressures on the family's elders.
The pacing of the disasters the family faces at this juncture is absolutely relentless, and it forces their hand into making some truly terrible decisions.
Yeah.
Just as they are attempting to manage the fallout of the forged jade and Bao Yu's declining mental state, Zhifeng brings this devastating news.
And she brings this news to Lady Wang.
She brings this news directly to Lady Wang, who is Bao Yu's mother. The news is that Wang Ziteng has died.
And who is he exactly?
Now, for the listener to understand the sheer weight of this, Wang Ziteng isn't just a beloved uncle. He is Lady Wang's brother, and he holds an incredibly high military rank.
Okay.
He was a primary political shield for the Jia family at the imperial court. His existence provided a protective umbrella over their various financial and social maneuvers.
And the details of his death are so frustratingly mundane, which I think almost makes it worse.
Oh, it definitely makes it worse.
Hmm. Because he didn't die heroically in battle, and he didn't die of old age surrounded by his descendants. Jaelian investigates the logistics and uncovers the specifics, and it's just sad.
It wasn't an assassination by political rivals either.
Right. It was a simple cold. He was traveling back to the capital, and he made it to a place called Shiliton, which is only 200 lights away.
Very close.
For context, 200 lies is roughly 60 or 70 miles. He was practically on their doorstep.
Yeah, just a few days' ride.
He got sick. A local provincial doctor in this rural town dispensed the wrong medicine, and he died suddenly. It's medical malpractice in a small town taking down one of the most powerful men in the entire empire.
It really highlights the extreme fragility of power in this era. You can survive the deadly politics of the imperial court only to be killed by an incompetent rural pharmacist.
Wow.
And the emotional and physical toll this takes on Lady Wang is immediate and severe.
I can imagine.
The source notes detail that her heartbreak translates directly into severe chest pains. She is physically incapable of sitting up. Her body is just absorbing the shocks of this collapsing system.
It's all too much.
She is mourning the loss of her brother. She is mourning the loss of her family's political shield. And she is terrified for her sick son, Bao Yu, who is just wandering around with a blank mind. She is completely paralyzed by grief.
Which isolates Jia Zheng, the patriarch. And Jia Zheng is currently caught in an absolutely impossible predicament that, frankly, perfectly illustrates the tension of the Confucian system.
Yes, he is stuck.
He has just been promoted to the position of Jiangxi Green Intendant by the emperor himself.
Which is huge.
We need to explain what that means. This isn't just a fancy title on a piece of paper. A grain intendant in the Qing dynasty was a massive, incredibly lucrative, and highly scrutinized position.
You are managing the agricultural tax revenue for an entire province.
It is a massive honor. It's a direct result of an imperial evaluation, and he is commanded to leave for his new post immediately.
Right away.
But look at the vice grip he is in here. On one side, he has his career duty, the literal command of the emperor, which is the highest law of the land.
You don't ignore that.
No. On the other side, he has his grieving wife, the strict cultural requirements of the mourning period for his brother-in-law, and most importantly, his deeply ill son.
Jia Xing's situation is the ultimate test of Confucian priorities.
Right.
In the Confucian system, the two highest virtues are filial piety, which is your duty to your family and your ancestors, and imperial loyalty, your duty to the state.
And usually those go hand in hand.
Usually these are perfectly aligned, but here they are in direct aggressive conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Jia Xing is totally paralyzed.
Yeah.
Furthermore, his relationship with Bai Yu is deeply complicated. The text explicitly notes that Jia Xing harbors a deep resentment toward Bai Yu's lack of traditional ambition.
Oh, interesting.
There's this famous phrase used, hating iron for not becoming steel.
Oh, I've heard that.
Yeah. Jia Xing wanted a son who would ace the imperial examinations and become a stern bureaucrat, just like him.
Right.
Instead, he got Bai Yu, a poetic, hypersensitive boy, who frankly prefers making rouge with maids to studying statecraft.
Yes, and yet, despite all that resentment and disappointment, Jia Xing is terrified of losing his heir. Because if Bai Yu dies, the direct lineage is completely threatened.
Exactly.
But even more terrifying to Jia Xing is the prospect of angering the matriarch, Grandmother Jia, because she dotes on Bai Yu completely.
He's her favorite.
So, if Jia Xing leaves for his post and Bai Yu dies in his absence, Grandmother Jia will blame him for abandoning his family. But if he stays to care for his son, he disobeys the emperor, which could result in the entire family being stripped of their titles.
Or worse, executed for treason.
Executed for treason. He is completely trapped in the gears of the system he dedicated his entire life to.
Which creates a massive vacuum of leadership.
Right.
Jia Xing cannot act.
Yeah.
Lady Wang is physically incapacitated by grief. This forces Grandmother Jia, the 81-year-old matriarch, to step into the void and take absolute control.
Wow, 81.
Yes. She calls Jia Xing in for a meeting. She uses her advanced age as a weapon, crying and reminding him of his filial duty to her. And then she proposes a radical, desperate solution to the crisis.
Okay.
She proposes a Chengxi marriage.
Let's really drill down into the mechanics of this, because this is where the story shifts from like a political drama into something deeply unsettled.
Very unsettling.
Grandmother Jia explains that a fortune teller has been consulted regarding Bai Yu's illness.
Right.
And the fortune teller claims that Bai Yu has lost his vital spirit. And the only way to save his life is to introduce a massive counterforce. He needs to marry a person with a quote-unquote gold destiny to wash away the bad luck and shock his system back to life.
That's the prescription.
So she decides unilaterally that Bao Yu must immediately marry Bao Chai. Now, Bao Chai is another cousin living in the compound who famously wears a golden locket with an inscription that perfectly matches the inscription on Bao Yu's lost jade.
It's all very cosmically aligned.
The learner, if you are listening to this and thinking it sounds like they are trying to cure a neurological breakdown with astrology, you are exactly right.
That's exactly what it is.
Walk us through the concept of Chengxi. How did they view this culturally at the time?
Well, Chengxi is a critical cultural and medical mechanism to understand here. It translates roughly to washing away sorrow with joy or warding off bad luck with a happy event.
Okay.
We cannot look at this purely as a cynical manipulation, though it absolutely becomes one. In the cosmological worldview of the time, the universe operates on the balance of yin and yang and the five elements.
Right. Medicine and cosmology were deeply intertwined.
Bai Yu's condition, the loss of his jade, his blank mind, his physical wasting away, is diagnosed as a catastrophic depletion of his vital yang energy.
Caused by what?
Caused by an influx of dark, sorrowful yin energy from all the recent tragedies, like the uncle's death.
Ah, okay.
And a wedding, by definition, is the ultimate generator of joyous yang energy.
So it's almost like they are trying to jumpstart his heart with a defibrillator, but instead of electricity, they are using ceremonial energy.
That is exactly it. It is sympathetic magic. They genuinely believe that by orchestrating the most auspicious event possible, they can rewrite his physical reality.
Wow.
And the addition of Bao Chai is the specific prescription. According to the five elements, her gold destiny, represented by her golden locket, is meant to magically resonate with his missing jade.
Because jade is earth element.
Yes, jade falls under the earth element. The fortune teller is essentially prescribing a cosmological formula.
Combine the gold destiny bride with the depleted groom.
Right, in a high energy ceremonial setting, and the missing earth or jade energy will just be summoned back. They are treating a severe psychological crisis with a ceremonial superstitious act.
But I have to question the underlying motives here.
Go for it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Is Grandmother Gia actually doing this solely to cure Bayou's illness? Or is the medical emergency just a very convenient excuse to execute a massive political consolidation?
Oh, that's the big question.
Think about it. With the patriarch leaving for his new post in Jiangxi, the political shield of Wang Ziteng dead, the family name becoming street gossip due to the counterfeiter, and the family finances bleeding out, Grandmother Gia is looking at a fractured empire.
It's crumbling.
Right. And by forcing this marriage to Bao Chai, she is locking down the family wealth, because Bao Chai's family, the Xu family, is incredibly wealthy.
Very wealthy.
She is satisfying a prophecy, and she is establishing a firm alliance that secures the family's future. It feels less like a medical intervention and more like a hostile corporate merger disguised as a cure.
Yes, and that duality is what makes Grandmother Gia such an incredible, formidable figure.
Right.
She is entirely capable of believing in the cosmological truth of the Chunxi cure while simultaneously reaping the massive political benefits of the alliance.
She can hold both truths.
Exactly. The genius of her plan is that it solves multiple systemic crises at once. It cures the heir, it secures the finances, and it creates a narrative of joyous stability in the face of public scandal.
It's a win-win-win.
However, what makes it so ruthlessly systemic is that the individual desires of the two people actually getting married are considered completely irrelevant.
They don't matter at all.
Not a bit. Bao Yu and Bao Chai are not viewed as individuals with agency. They are strategic assets to be deployed for the survival of the family system.
But decreeing a grand sweeping plan from the top down is the easy part.
Oh, absolutely.
The real challenge is the execution. Actually pulling off a secret forced marriage in a household populated by hundreds of hyper-observant gossiping servants with complex interwoven relationships and hidden loyalties.
It's a nightmare.
It requires logistical genius and, frankly, extreme cruelty. The architecture of deceit, the massive logistical hurdles they face, and the devastating tactical shift they are forced to make when a critical piece of intelligence comes to light.
The logistical nightmare of executing this Chunxi marriage really cannot be overstated.
Tell me about it.
Grandmother Gia's plan immediately slams into three massive, almost insurmountable walls. First, the bride's brother, Xu Pan, is currently sitting in jail.
Oh, right.
Xu Pan is a notoriously violent, spoiled heir who frequently relies on his family's money to bail him out of trouble, often involving manslaughter.
Yikes.
Yeah. And a family cannot properly celebrate a wedding when the head of the bride's household is imprisoned. It taints the auspicious nature of the event and creates legal complications.
Right. And the second hurdle is even bigger. The entire Gia family is in an official state of mourning for the imperial concubine Yuanchen.
Yes, that's a huge problem.
Yuanchen was Bao Yu's older sister who was elevated to the emperor's court. Her recent death means the family is strictly forbidden by imperial decree from hosting joyous celebrations, banquets, or playing music.
It's illegal.
Right. Hosting a wedding during imperial mourning is a direct insult to the emperor and is highly illegal. And the third hurdle is time. Jia Zhang has an imperial deadline to assume his post in Jiangxi.
He has to go.
He cannot delay his departure. So they are completely boxed in by legal, cultural, and temporal constraints.
And because Grandmother Gia refuses to accept medical reality, she's forced to turn to logistical impossibility.
How do you even do that?
Right. How do you hide a wedding from the groom, the government, and the household?
You can't.
She devises a stealth wedding. It's essentially a covert operations mission, operating under the guise of medical treatment.
Wow.
They will script the wedding of all its traditional hallmarks. Huh. They will skip the massive banquets that usually span days.
No parties?
No parties.
Yeah.
There'll be absolutely no music, which is normally the loudest and most public declaration of a marriage.
Okay.
They will use exactly 12 pairs of palace-style lanterns and an 8-person sedan chair to move the bride quietly in the night.
That sounds so spooky.
The visual of this is incredibly striking, right? A silent, glowing procession moving through the dark courtyards of the compound, conducting a wedding like it's a clandestine smuggling operation.
And their superstitious hope is that simply going through the physical motions of the ceremony and bringing Bao Chai's gold lock into Bao Yu's room will magically summon back his lost jade.
They're betting everything on it.
They are betting the entire future of the family on this magical resonance. But this is where the grand top-down theories of the elders crash violently into the ground-level reality of human emotion.
The human element always ruins the plan.
Always. The plan hits a massive wall when Jiren intervenes. For the learner to grasp the weight of this, we really need to explain who Jiren is. She is not just a maid.
No, not at all.
She is Bao Yu's principal maid. She manages his daily life, his clothes, his schedule, and she's essentially his common law concubine.
She is his closest confidant.
She knows the intimate, moment-to-moment reality of Bao Yu's mind better than his own mother does.
And Jiren represents the ground-level truth in this narrative. She overhears the elders plotting this stealth wedding to Bao Chai.
What does she do?
She bypasses the normal chain of command and goes directly to Lady Wang. The text describes her weeping, dropping to her knees, and risking severe punishment to deliver a warning.
Because she knows something they don't.
Jiren knows a deadly secret that the elders either don't know or just refuse to acknowledge. Bao Yu is exclusively, deeply, and obsessively in love with Dai Yu, the fragile, poetic cousin who also lives in the compound.
Right, so Jiren explicitly warns Lady Wang that if they proceed with this plan, if Bao Yu finds out he is marrying Bao Chai instead of Dai Yu, the shock won't cure him.
It will kill him.
It will kill him. She literally calls it a catalyst for his death. She reminds Lady Wang of past incidents where Bao Yu threatened to smash his magical jade or throw himself into a well just over the mere thought of losing Dai Yu.
He is incredibly fragile.
Jiren is telling the management that their prescribed cure is actually a lethal poison.
Yes, and this confrontation between Jiren and Lady Wang is the philosophical core of the tragedy.
How so?
It is the clash between the top-down belief in systemic destiny and the bottom-up reality of human psychology.
Okay, unpack that.
Well, the elders, Grandmother Jia and Lady Wang, believe in gold locks, fortune tellers, and the power of ceremonial structure. They believe that if you put the right pieces into the right slots, the machine will work.
Right. They see it as a mechanical process.
Jiren, however, believes in the actual, messy, undeniable psychological state of the boy she cares for. She forces the adults to reckon with the fact that Bao Yu has his own internal world, a fiercely protected inner reality that simply cannot be overridden by an astrological chart or a matriarch's decree.
So the elders are faced with the stark reality. Their carefully planned cure might instantly kill the patient. Do they cancel the stealth wedding?
Of course not.
Do they reconsider the emotional well-being of the children? Of course not. They don't cancel. They pivot. The machine must keep moving.
The machine always keeps moving.
And to solve this new, highly sensitive psychological problem, they turn to Xifeng, the ruthless COO we mentioned earlier.
Right, Xifeng.
Xifeng listens to the problem and comes up with a Machiavellian solution so dark it fundamentally alters the moral fabric of the family.
It's pure evil, honestly.
She proposes the bait and switch, or in the original text, diabaware.
Xifeng's tactical brilliance is matched only by her profound emotional cruelty here.
Yeah.
She analyzes the data. Bao Yu needs the ceremonial energy of the wedding to survive, but he will die if he knows the bride is Bao Chai.
So what's her solution?
Her solution is to entirely erase his agency through a massive campaign of gaslighting.
Wow.
The plan is simple and devastating. They will tell Bao Yu that Grandmother Jia has finally agreed to let him marry Dai Yu.
Oh, that's cruel.
They will use his deepest, most profound love as a weapon to force his compliance. By telling him he is marrying Dai Yu, they will elevate his spirits, generate the joyous yang energy required by the Changxi ritual, and get him to willingly participate in the ceremony.
But on the actual wedding night, when the bride is brought in under the red veil, they will have secretly put Bao Chai in the wedding bed. It is a stunning violation of trust. Okay, let me get this straight. Think about the mechanics of this from a modern perspective. It's like a devastating corporate bait and switch, but enacted on human lives.
Oh, absolutely.
You order the premium product, the company smiles, assures you it's on the way, takes your money, and then ships you something entirely different, knowing you won't realize you've been scammed until you've already signed the irreversible contract and opened the box.
That's a great way to put it.
They are intentionally prescribing a psychological placebo to a dying man.
That is the perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And they know that the placebo will eventually wear off.
Right.
When Bao Yu wakes up after the wedding and the veil is lifted, he will see Bao Chai. He will realize that the entire family, his mother, his grandmother, his trusted servants, all conspired to trick him.
Everyone he loves lied to him.
And that truth might utterly destroy what is left of his mind.
Which raises the ultimate question about this architecture of deceit. Are they actually trying to protect Bayou, or are they just protecting themselves from dealing with his immediate violent reaction to the truth?
It's self-preservation.
Because if they tell him he's marrying Baoshai right now, he will have a catastrophic breakdown, refuse to participate, ruin the Changshi ritual, ruin Jia Zhang's timeline for departure, and jeopardize the alliance with the Su family.
It ruins everything for the elders.
By lying to him, they get him through the ceremony. They secure the political and spiritual win on paper. Whatever psychological fallout happens after the wedding is just a problem for tomorrow.
Let tomorrow worry about tomorrow.
It is the ultimate act of institutional self-preservation at the direct cost of the individual's sanity.
It is the defining flaw of the family system. They prioritize the preservation of the structure over the survival of the souls trapped within it. They believe a controlled, temporary lie is superior to a chaotic truth.
But as you can imagine, the learner constructing a lie of this magnitude inside a sprawling compound with hundreds of servants is mathematically impossible to maintain.
You just can't do it.
The architecture of deceit is fundamentally flawed because it relies entirely on the absolute silence of people who have absolutely nothing to lose and who don't even understand the stakes of the game they are playing.
And servants, yeah.
You cannot compartmentalize information when your house has no actual compartments, just paper walls and gossiping maids.
Paper walls, exactly.
This sets the stage for the tragic leak. And the entire grand conspiracy, plotted by the most powerful women in the empire, hinges on a dropped handkerchief and a maid who is literally nicknamed Silly.
The narrative shift here is just brilliant.
It really is.
We move away from the claustrophobic, high-stakes scheming of the matriarchs in the inner chambers, and we step out into the quiet, lonely, and decaying paths of the Grand View Garden. It is here we find Dayu.
Dayu, right.
Dayu is the young woman who is secretly the true love of Bayou. She is entirely unaware of the massive machinery operating against her inside the mansion.
Let's paint the picture of Dayu in this moment. She's walking after breakfast. She realizes she has dropped her handkerchief somewhere along the path.
A simple mistake.
She sends her devoted maid, Zihuan, back to retrace their steps and find it. This seemingly insignificant logistical detail, a dropped piece of fabric leaves Dayu completely alone near the Kinfang Bridge.
The geography of this scene is heavy with poetic irony.
Why is that?
The Kinfang Bridge is the exact location where, in much happier times, Dayu and Bayou used to read banned poetry together and bury fallen flower petals to protect them from the dirt.
Oh, wow.
It is the geographic and emotional center of their romance. And as she stands there alone, waiting for her maid to return with a handkerchief, the silence of the garden is broken. She hears someone crying.
Who is it?
She investigates and finds a maid named Sha Daji, which translates directly to Silly Sister.
We need to explain Sha Daji's place in the hierarchy because it is crucial to how the information leaks. The Jia household has an incredibly rigid class structure, even among the servants.
Right? Very rigid, yes.
You have senior maids like Jiren, who wield real power, and then you have lower-level maids who do the heavy physical labor. Sha Daji is a rough-handed, unintelligent girl employed specifically for hard labor.
She's at the very bottom.
She doesn't understand poetry, she doesn't understand the complex politics of the inner chambers, and she certainly doesn't understand the nuance of the Changshi deception.
Not all.
And right now she is sobbing because she was just physically slapped by a senior maid named Zenzu.
The profound literary irony in this text is just devastating. Consider the contrast here.
Right.
Dayu is arguably the most highly intelligent, hypersensitive, poetically gifted character in the entire narrative. She communicates in metaphors and subtle glances.
And then there's Sha Daji.
And her life, her entire reality, is about to be utterly destroyed by the most oblivious, low-level, literal-minded servant in the entire house. The grand, impenetrable plans of the powerful elders are undone by a careless whisper from someone who doesn't even grasp the meaning of her own words.
So Dayu, being empathetic, asks Sha Daji why she's crying. And Sha Daji, innocently and casually, complains that she was hit just for gossiping.
Just for talking.
And what was the gossip? Without any preamble, without any malice, she casually drops the atomic bomb.
Boom.
She mentions that she was just talking about how everyone is secretly preparing for Bayou to marry Baoshai. And then, almost as an afterthought to justify her gossip, she mentions that the family's secondary plan is to quickly find a mother-in-law for Miss Lin, meaning Dayu, to marry her off and get her out of the way.
It's brutal.
She says all of this directly to Dayu's face, not even realizing who she is talking to or the apocalyptic weight of the words she is speaking.
It is a localized psychological extinction event.
That's a strong phrase.
The way the source text describes Dayu's immediate internal reaction is one of the most remarkable and medically accurate descriptions of profound trauma in classical literature.
How so?
The text says that upon hearing these words, Dayu's feelings were a chaotic mixture of oil, soy sauce, sugar, and vinegar. Sweet, bitter, sour, and salty, all poured together at once.
That metaphor, it's so visceral.
It really is.
It's not just saying, you know, she was incredibly sad or she was shocked. It's a description of total sensory overload.
Yes, and if we connect this to the bigger picture of human neurology, it represents a complete psychological short circuit.
Okay.
When a human being experiences profound, reality-shattering trauma, the brain doesn't just process one clean, identifiable emotion like sadness or anger.
Right, it's a mess.
The parasympathetic nervous system crashes. The sensory metaphor of the clashing condiments, the heavy oil, the sharp vinegar, the sweet shit, the salty soy sauce, means her nervous system is receiving intensely conflicting signals simultaneously.
It's too much data.
It's an absolute cognitive overload where the processing faculties simply shut down. She can no longer process emotion. The data is too massive and too contradictory. She can only experience the physical collapse of her reality.
So what does this all mean for Dayu in this exact moment? Think about the layers of betrayal she is absorbing simultaneously.
It's unimaginable.
She's hearing the absolute worst news possible, the perceived betrayal of her true love, the sinister plotting of her entire family, her own impending forced exile from the only home she knows.
Everything she knows is a lie.
And she's not hearing it from a gloating rival or a cruel elder formally delivering a verdict. She's hearing it from a laborer who doesn't even comprehend the weapon she's wielding.
Right.
Isn't this the ultimate nightmare of living in a rigid, hierarchical society? It proves that you have absolutely zero control over your own fate. You are the focal point of the tragedy, yet you are the absolute last person to know your own destiny.
It is the absolute pinnacle of powerlessness. Dayu realizes in that one moment by the bridge that she is not a participant in her own life.
She's just an object.
She is merely an object, a logistical hurdle to be managed and disposed of by the adults. The careless, accidental way the information is delivered underscores how little her inner life matters to the systemic machinery of the family.
Yeah.
Her entire universe, which was built entirely on the foundational assumption of Bayou's love and understanding, is casually dismantled by a passing comment from a silly maid complaining about a slap cheek.
And we watch, almost in real time, as her physical body tries to process this impossible, paradoxical reality. We follow Dayu's physical breakdown as she walks straight out of the garden and into the heart of madness.
This part is so hard to read.
Which brings us to the climax of this two broken minds.
The physiological description of her trauma response here is stunning and deeply unsettling.
What happens?
After hearing the news and experiencing that sensory short circuit, the text says Dayu's body suddenly feels like it weighs 1,000 pounds. She can barely lift her legs.
But at the same time.
Yet simultaneously, her feet feel like they are stepping on cotton. She has lost all proprioception. Her brain is no longer accurately communicating with her limbs.
She's disassociated.
She is experiencing severe acute dissociation. She begins to wander aimlessly, actually getting lost in her own home. She walks in the wrong direction, adding unnecessary distance to her journey. She is completely unmoored from physical reality.
When her maid, Ziwan, finally returns with the handkerchief and finds her, Dayu is unrecognizable.
She's a ghost.
She is ghostly pale. Her eyes are entirely vacant, and she refuses all assistance. She just blankly states, I'm going to ask Bayou.
Just that one sentence.
She turns and walks like a ghost straight into Bayou's courtyard, bypassing all the guards and servants. And what follows is deeply chilling.
Very chilling.
The learner, if you are watching a modern drama, this is the moment you expect the massive fight. You expect screaming, crying, throwing porcelain, demanding answers. But there is none of that.
No. What happens is far more disturbing than a screaming match. It is a masterclass in psychological horror, precisely because of what doesn't happen.
Right.
Dayu walks into Bayou's room. They do not greet each other. They do not observe any of the strict mandatory etiquette required by their Confucian society.
You have to sit there.
They simply sit face to face. And they smile foolishly at each other. They just stare into each other's eyes and smile in complete silence.
It's so eerie. The silence is deafening. And then we hit the breaking point dialogue.
Yes.
Dayu simply asks, in a flat tone, Bayou, why are you sick? And Bayou, looking right at her, replies, I am sick for Miss Lin. He says this directly to Miss Lin.
It is the absolute truth, spoken through a thick, impenetrable veil of madness.
Wow.
Their minds are fully retreated from a reality that is simply too painful for their conscious brains to bear. The total lack of histrionics, the absence of anger, makes it infinitely worse because it shows that the damage is terminal.
They are completely broken.
They haven't just been hurt emotionally. Their core cognitive functions have been shattered by the architecture of deceit built by their family.
It's a permanent break.
Bayou's statement, I am sick for Miss Lin, is profound. His physical eyes do not recognize the physical Dayu sitting right in front of him. But his soul, his fractured subconscious, is still entirely, exclusively fixated on the concept of her.
It reads less like a tragic romance and more like a psychological thriller.
Oh, absolutely.
That shared silent smiling, it's like they've both been completely unplugged from the matrix of the Jia family's lies. The strict social codes, the arranged marriages, the imperial decrees, none of it exists in that room.
It all just fades away.
They are the only two people in the entire sprawling compound who are telling the pure truth, but the ultimate tragedy is that they had to lose their minds to do it. Have the elders' desperate attempts to cure Bayou by building this massive apparatus of deception actually ended up executing Dayu?
Yes, the cure was a fatal poison. And we see the final, violent, physiological response to this psychological death immediately after this conversation.
Right.
Dayu suddenly stands up from the chair. She claims, very casually, that it's time to go home. And she begins to walk back to her pavilion.
She's moving weirdly.
But she doesn't walk normally. She walks supernaturally fast. She's practically flying across the courtyards.
Her maids are terrified because they can barely keep up with her. She is walking with a terrifying mechanical speed. And just as she reaches the door of her own home, the sanctuary of her pavilion, she leans forward, vomits a massive mouthful of blood, and collapses to the ground.
That supernatural walking speed is a well-documented physiological phenomenon in cases of extreme shock.
Is it really?
Yes. It is a massive final adrenaline surge of a dying system. Her body, running entirely on the fumes of panic and dissociation, pushed itself beyond its physical limits just to reach the perceived safety of her own threshold.
But it was too late.
But the damage was already done. The violent physical rupture of vomiting blood, whether interpreted medically as a ruptured stress ulcer or esophageal varices from underlying illness, or interpreted literally as the physical manifestation of a broken heart, is the inescapable conclusion.
The pressure was too much.
The immense psychological pressure applied by the family's lies finally broke the physical vessel.